This morning, I want to ask you a question about what kind of books you're reading. How many of you have ever read Don Quixote? Raise your hand. Don Quixote. Very, very few of you. Do you know the story about Don Quixote? So I only know just one scene from the story. I've actually never read the book. I don't even know if it's a movie. But anyway, Don Quixote was written in 1605. This is a long time ago, 1605, and it's called the most influential work of literature from the entire Spanish literary canon. It's a founding work of most Western literature. It's often labeled as the very first modern novel, although 1605 hardly sounds modern, does it? But what we understand is novel literature, that kind of thing. This is considered one of the very first. The plot of Don Quixote revolves around an adventurous nobleman named La Mancha, or from La Mancha, named Alonso, I'm going to mess this name up, Quijano or something like that, Alonso. So he reads so many chivalry romance stories. That's how this story goes. He reads all these romance chivalrous stories that he loses his mind. Oh, I love that. Don't read too many romances, I guess. So anyway, he loses his mind and he decides to become a knight. And he's going to restore chivalry to his beloved country. And he changes his name to Don Quixote de la Mancha. And he recruits a simple farmer named Sancho Panza as his squire, and then Don Quixote and Sancho go traveling all over the country. And in the first part of the book, Don Quixote is not seeing the world as it actually is. And that's the whole thing about reality versus fantasy that makes this kind of a timeless classic. He doesn't see the world as it actually is. He sees the world as he prefers to see it, okay? He imagines that he's living out this knightly story, and he's the chivalrous hero who's going to restore this chivalry back to his country. Now, the most famous scene in the story is he and Sancho are traveling around, and they come to a field of windmills, which Don Quixote is convinced is a group of giants. And Don Quixote says to Sancho, I'm going to go fight these giants and I'm going to steal their treasure and make it my own. And Sancho turns to him and he says, no, those are not giants. Those are windmills. And Don Quixote says back to his buddy, hey, those are giants. The evil magician Freston has changed the giants into windmills because he wants to deprive me of my victory and steal my plunder. So off he goes to slay the giants. And as he starts fighting these giants, he gets his sword stuck in one of the sails as it's turning around the arm of the windmill. It's a humorous story about a delightful man who had really good intentions but was not quite in touch with reality. That's the story of Don Quixote. It's a timeless classic, and it could be your story. It could be yours. Because sometimes when we look at windmills, we see giants. Right? And like a lot of comedy stories, it's a really funny story until it's not funny anymore. And the point gets driven home that sometimes we're out of touch with things as they really are. And while it makes for a humorous story that is a timeless classic, it's not very funny when we don't see things as they really are. And under our deception, we begin acting in a certain way that's not consistent with reality. And I'm telling you, we all do this. We do. When you think about what's the greatest reality that there is, it's God. And when you realize that when we're born into this world, our relationship with God is broken, the reality is we're out of touch with reality as we come into this world. And then we create these identities, you and I do, because we don't know who we are, and we turn to other people who are out of touch with reality. By the way, if you go to a psychotherapist's office and you are out of touch with reality, you're labeled insane, right? So in our insane, sinful condition, we turn to other insane, sinful people and ask them to tell us who we are. This is what we do all the time until we get back in touch with reality. And come to understand who God is. And in our relationship with God, we get in touch with reality. And to the degree that we're in touch with God and we're trusting Him and we're walking with Him, we're in touch with reality. And to the degree that we go off on our own, we're in touch with our own insanity. And again, it's a funny story until it starts hitting home. So today's story, in the book of Daniel, is a story very much about people in touch with reality and other people who are kind of living in a fantasy world. So I want to review kind of where we've been in the last couple of chapters. We're in Daniel chapter 3 today, and in the first two chapters, we learned about a guy named Daniel and his friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and they were Jews who were taken by force out of their homeland in Israel and forced to live in Babylon, the land of their enemies. Daniel and these three friends, though, were kind of singled out among those people that were captives and were trained and given physical benefits of food and all those kind of things, and then eventually given places and positions of honor. Daniel politely requested that they not have to eat the king's food and drink. You remember that story? So that he wouldn't disregard God's purpose for him and defile himself. And he risks his life by going up and saying, I don't want to eat that stuff. I don't want to drink the king's wine. Just give me vegetables. The risk wasn't that he would die of starvation. The risk was the king wouldn't approve and kill him because the king is insane. The king blesses these guys because they go 10 days without the king's food and they're physically fit. And so the king says, yep, these guys are set apart and they're given these special places of honor. Well, then King Nebuchadnezzar had a disturbing dream. In the last couple of weeks, we looked at that dream and the whole circumstances around it, where King Nebuchadnezzar says to all the wise people and all the soothsayers, all the astrologers, all the magicians, he says, I had a dream last night. I couldn't sleep. Now, you guys tell me what the dream was and tell me what it means. And they came back to him and said, that's impossible. Tell us what the dream was, and then we'll tell you what it means. He goes, no, you're stalling for time, and I know what you're doing. You're bluffing. Because if I tell you the dream and then you tell me what it means, how do I know that you're telling me what it actually means and that you just didn't make something up? So in order for me to have confidence that you know the meaning of this dream, you tell me the dream and then you tell me what it means. And everybody says, that's impossible. The king says, fine, you're all dead. I'm going to kill every one of you. And then when they come to kill Daniel, Daniel says, time out, what's the deal? And the guy coming to kill him says, well, nobody could tell the king what the dream was and what it meant. Daniel says, give me some time. And then Daniel goes to his three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He says, guys, we got to pray. And they start praying, and they pray, and they pray, and they pray. And then God shows to Daniel that night what the dream was and what it means. He goes back and tells the king, here's the dream. Here's what it means. The king is blown away. He worships Daniel, and he tells everybody else that Daniel's God's the greatest God, and everybody should worship Daniel's God. So that's where we left off last week. Now, this week in chapter 3, there's another episode in this story. And in Daniel 3, starting at verse 1, we read this. King Nebuchadnezzar made a gold statue 90 feet tall and 9 feet wide and set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Now just look at this for a minute. He set up a 90-foot, so that's a, be like a 9-story or so skyscraper, very tall structure made out of what? Gold. Now, what? If you've been following along over the last couple weeks, or if you know the story of the dream the king had in chapter 2, what's the significance of gold? Well, the king had a dream about a statue. And in that statue, he saw 4 kingdoms. The head was made out of gold. And Daniel said, O King Nebuchadnezzar, that's you in the Babylonian Empire. You're the head of gold. And then it goes down, right? The silver, the bronze, and then the feet of clay, iron and clay, the legs of iron and the feet of iron and clay representing the Roman King Empire. And then this, in the dream, this rock that doesn't get cut out by a man, but a rock that gets cut out of the mountain, then smashes the feet of the statue. The statue topples over. The rock becomes a mountain. We talk about how that kingdom is the kingdom of Christ, the kingdom of God that came during the Roman Empire. Okay, so King Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. He knows, because Daniel told him, your kingdom is the gold kingdom, but your kingdom's going to come to an end. The Babylonians reigned for about 100 years. Nebuchadnezzar builds an entire statue 90 feet tall made out of entirely gold. And the idea is, this is the way I see it. Okay? This is my impression. My impression is he built a statue of himself 90 feet tall, and the whole thing's out of gold, as if to say, oh no, my statue, me and my kingdom are not going to get crumbled. We're going to last for forever. Now that's my interpretation of it, only because I know what a ego-centered jerk Nebuchadnezzar is. And he's obsessed with his power, and you'll see this here in a moment. Now, whether that's exactly his intention or not, I'm just throwing that out there as an option of, to give you an idea of the kind of person that we're dealing with, kind of leader we're talking about here. But he builds an image, a statue, 90 feet tall, and I don't think it's an accident that he had just dreamed about having seen this giant statue. Okay, so he builds a statue 90 feet tall out in the plain of Dura. Then he sent messages to the high officers, governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, all the provincial officials to come to the dedication of the statue he had set up. So all these officials came, and they stood before the statue King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then a herald shouted out, "People of all races and nations and languages, listen to the king's command. When you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipes, and other musical instruments, bow to the ground to worship King Nebuchadnezzar's gold statue. Anyone who refuses to obey will immediately be thrown into a blazing furnace." So, at the sound of the musical instruments, all the people, whatever their race or nation or language, bowed to the ground and worshiped the gold statue that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. But some of the astrologers went to the king and informed on the Jews. He's going to rat these guys out. They said to King Nebuchadnezzar, "Long live the king. You issued a decree requiring all the people to bow down and worship the gold statue when they heard the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipes, and other musical instruments. That decree also states that those who refuse to obey must be thrown into a blazing furnace. But there are some Jews," and then he names Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Interestingly, he doesn't name Daniel. Even though Daniel's the one that the book is named after, and up to this point had been the main character in the story, but at this point he only mentions Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Don't assume because Daniel's not mentioned that Daniel did bow down. You shouldn't make assumption. Daniel could have been just as obstinate in this as these guys, and they only chose to call these three out for whatever reasons. We're never told. Daniel could have been traveling over the provinces somewhere on business. We're never told. Daniel's not brought up in this text, but don't assume Daniel caved in. It doesn't sound like the character of Daniel, right? Don't assume Daniel caved in and bowed down to this thing. So they rat out these three, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, whom you have put in charge of the province of Babylon. They pay no attention to you, your majesty. They refuse to serve your gods and do not worship the gold statue you've set up. Then Nebuchadnezzar flew into a rage and ordered that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought before him. When they were brought in, Nebuchadnezzar said to them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you refuse to serve my gods or to worship the gold statue I have set up? I will give you one more chance," which is interesting, isn't it? It's interesting. He's going to give them another chance. Because his command was, anyone who doesn't do it will immediately be thrown into the furnace. But he's going to give them a chance. I think he cares about these guys. I think he doesn't want to do this. "I will give you one more chance to bow down and worship the statue I have made when you hear the sound of the musical instruments. But if you refuse, you will be thrown immediately into the blazing furnace." Now, here's the key sentence in this so far. "And then, what God will be able to rescue you from my power?" Just think about that sentence for just a moment. We've been talking so far in the book of Daniel about what kind of God do we have? What kind of God do we have? And Nebuchadnezzar asks that very question. "Gentlemen, what kind of God do you have? What God is there? Where are you going to find a God that will rescue you from what? my power. I looked up the definition of megalomaniac. It's just a fun word to say. I look up the definition of megalomaniac. A megalomaniac is someone who is obsessed with their own power. That's Nebuchadnezzar. What God is there who will rescue you from me? I think about all the great stories that have come out in recent days that have a similar theme about government or those in power who are obsessed with their own power and then come down with an iron fist, you know, on any dissenters. So, of course, this isn't necessarily a new story, but Star Wars came out back in the 70s and continues, you know, into recent times. But the theme is very similar to this. You have an empire, right, that's going to dominate and crush anybody who refuses to submit to them and their leadership. So you have, you know, if you're not familiar with the Star Wars story, it's really the empire, this strong, dominant, the people in power, and then the rebellion. The good guys are the rebels, right? The rebellion. But there are other stories that have come out in more recent days, like the Hunger Games, fighting against the Capitol. The Capitol has all the power, and all the people out in these districts have no power. And so it's a story about rebelling against the Capitol and trying to bring justice for everybody because the Capitol is just wanting to domineer and crush people. The Divergent series, that was a series of books, became movies. The Matrix from a number of years ago. The Maze Runner, another story. The Gladiator story, which is a really great one from the Roman times, right? Where you have this dominating power that's crushing rebellion. In our day, in reality, this is going on in places like China as we speak. It was horrifying. And as freedom-loving Americans, we can't and don't want to imagine what life would be like under a totalitarian type of government. King Nebuchadnezzar was about as totalitarian as it got. If you aren't going to worship me, I will kill you. I was sitting here thinking about the story as I was reading about this, and I was trying to process even just the timing of all this stuff. How long do you think it took to build a 90-foot gold statue? Just think about that for a minute. How long? Is it too long of a time to say it might have taken a couple months to build it? Now, if you are from around here in Spearfish, you know when somebody's building a new structure in town, like you're just driving down Jackson Boulevard and you see somebody's like, you kind of rubberneck a little bit, and you're like, hey, what are they? I wonder what they're building. And then you get to your work, wherever it is, you go, hey, did you see the new construction that's going on over there on the corner of the... Yeah, what is that? I don't know. Is it a new restaurant? I don't know. And then you finally talk to somebody who kind of has the inside story. Ooh, that's kind of juicy. And you start telling, I know what it is. And you find out what's going on, you know, the new business in town. And the chatter goes on. What kind of chatter do you think was going on in the Capitol while this giant statue is being... What are they doing out there in the Plain of Dura? What is that thing? Have you seen it? Yeah, what do you think it is? I don't know. Maybe it's a new coffee shop. Right? Like, what are they doing out there? It wouldn't have taken long before somebody kind of went, yeah, that looks a lot like Nebuchadnezzar, or that looks a lot like one of his gods, or whatever the design was. And I would imagine that in the weeks that was going on while that thing was being constructed and the chatter was about town, the Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego could see what was coming. And I kind of half wonder, did they already make up their mind before this ever, that day ever came? Did they already make up their mind? Yeah, I'm not going to bow down to that thing. And then I got to wondering, of the three of them, which one was the spokesperson? And how much courage did the other two have? Were they kind of just banking on their buddy to be the strong one? Have you ever wondered to yourself if you were forced to worship something like this, what you would do? I often like to think of myself as a hero. I can remember when I was younger thinking about, because I had learned this story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego when I was really little. And I remember thinking to myself, I'm going to be the hero. I'll be the one standing strong in the middle. Everybody else is, you know, on their knees and their face to the ground, but not me. I'm out there in the crowd just standing up like, screw you. I'm not going to bow down to your statue, right? I'm going to be the hero in the story. And then the Lord had to show me over the years how many times I'd lose my courage in the face of peer pressure. I didn't want to stand up for Jesus and be the freak, right? So I'm going to give you one more chance. You either bow down or I'm going to kill you. So in verse 16, we read their response. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied, O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you. Man, this is such a key statement here. I don't answer to you, King Nebuchadnezzar, you who think you have so much power. Right? I don't answer to you. You know, every other person that bowed down, every other one of them gave Nebuchadnezzar power over their heart. Every one of them did. And they say, we don't need to defend ourselves before you. We don't answer to you. We're not afraid of you. And I wondered this morning, who are you defending yourself to? Who do you defend yourself to? Do you know? Some people have received, and I don't know, is it possible to get through life growing up and not hear wounding and hurtful messages from people? To not hear things like, you'll never amount to anything. Or to hear things like, we don't want you. Or to hear things like, you'll never be lovable. And so many people hear those kind of wounding messages throughout their lifetime, and then they spend the rest of their lifetime trying to defend themselves to that voice that they've heard many years ago. You'll never amount to much. Oh, yeah? And then they become a workaholic and make millions of dollars so they feel successful so they can defend themselves in the front of whoever it was that thought they would never amount to anything. Some people are still really working their tails off to try to go back to that school reunion when they can prove to people what a success they were. I'll show you. I'll find my trophy wife and I'll show up in my Corvette or my Tesla or whatever it might be, right? I'll show you. And they work their whole life trying to prove they're a success. Other people react to those kind of messages in different ways. Other people react to, you'll never amount to anything, saying, oh yeah, I'll show you, because I ain't even going to care what you think. And they go on to be as unsuccessful as they can be, but the whole time they're just trying to prove to somebody they don't care what you said, but they do. Who are you trying to defend yourself to? Your dad? Your grandpa? Your mom? Who are you trying to prove something to? These guys said, we don't answer to you. I'm not trying to defend myself to you. You think you have all this power? Listen, I'm not giving you that kind of power to me. I'm not going to do it. It's one of the most freeing things that you can ever do in your life is when you say to those voices, you no longer have power over me. I don't answer to you anymore. But you know what? You'll never get to that place until you find out who you do answer to. And when you know the God, when you really know him, to whom you do answer, it's the most freeing thing you'll ever find because you don't have to prove anything to anybody. The one thing he would look you in the eye and say, you're a failure. And your only response is, you're right, I am. I'm a miserable failure. But then you would hear his voice, I love you anyway. And I gave my son for your failure so that you could be perfect in me. I love you right where you're at. It's a freeing, freeing, freeing thing. I don't know if you caught the Twitter thing that Tom Brady, do you know who Tom Brady is? He's a household name for many Americans. Tom Brady famously did not make the Super Bowl this year. But Tom Brady, back in January, just a few weeks ago, tweeted that he will be back. And in his tweet, he said, I quote, "I still have something to prove." And I think to myself, what does Tom Brady have to prove? And to whom? And it's not a judgment about Tom Brady. I love his drive. I do, even though I don't like the Patriots. I love his drive. But I wonder to myself, what does he have to prove? And I think to myself, well, what do I have to prove? And who is it I'm trying to prove it to? And it's freeing when you're no longer trying to answer to somebody else besides the Lord. So these guys, hey, we don't have to defend ourselves before you. Verse 17, they're still responding to the king. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God whom we serve. Remember the question was, what God will rescue you? Their response, the God whom we serve is able to save us. What kind of a God do we have? We have the kind of God who's able to save us. And then notice their bold statement about God, their confidence in what he would do. The God whom we serve is able to save us. He will rescue us from your power. Whose power? Yours. He's bigger than you, Nebuchadnezzar. He will rescue us from your power, your majesty. What kind of God do we have? We have the kind of God who will save us from your power. Now, what do they mean by save us from your power? Do they mean that if we die, we get to go to heaven and we'll be free from your power? I don't think that's what they meant at all. Not at all. And the reason I say that is because of what they're about to say. When they said that he will save us, they meant in this very situation, if you throw us in the furnace, God will save us. Listen, this is a place where so many people do not understand the role of God in their life right now. So many Christians have a concept of God that he saves us, meaning I get to go to heaven when I die, but between now and then, life can be miserable. They have a God who will rescue them from hell tomorrow, but they don't have a God who will set them free from the hell they're in right now. And so addictions have power over them. Other people have power over them. Disillusionment has power. Discouragement, depression, anxiety have power over them right now. I've met so many people, and I've been in this place myself where I would become what I would call a suicidal rapturist. There's a lot loaded into that question, but just for a moment, let me give you the concept. A theological concept, save the debate for another day. The concept of rapture is Jesus will come back any moment and take me away. And a suicidal rapturist, which I've been many times, is Jesus, come take me away because this life I'm living right now is horrible and I just want it to be over with. I wasn't wanting Jesus to show up so that I could see Jesus. I just wanted Jesus to show up to get me out of the misery I was in the moment. And so many believers, that's the extent of their relationship with Jesus. He's going to rescue me when I die someday, but right now I guess I'm just stuck in misery for the rest of my life. And I'm telling you, you do not know God like you think you know him if you think that's the Christian life. The Christian life is Christ in you right now. His life in you right now. In Romans chapter 5, verse 10, we read this. Look at Romans 5, 10 real quick. In Romans 5:10, Paul says, "For if while we were enemies, we were reconciled to God," that means having the relationship with God restored, so that now you get to live with him forever in heaven. That's the meaning of this. And how did that get accomplished? We were reconciled to God. How? By the death of his son. That's where many, many believers stop in their relationship with God. I've been reconciled to God by Jesus' death, his atonement for me. Now I get to go to heaven when I die. But Paul says, if that's true, that Jesus' death brought us reconciliation to God so that we get to live forever and ever in heaven, much more. How much more? Much more. Now that we are reconciled, now that we know we get to go to heaven when we die, shall we be saved by his what? Life. Not his death. His life. Which life? The one that's in you. And what does he mean by saved? In this moment, in your circumstance. Depression doesn't need to overwhelm you. You have the life of Christ in you. Anxiety doesn't need to be the master over you. You have the life of Christ in you. You can be saved by his life today. Right now. And that's where these guys were at. God's going to save us from, you throw us in the flames all you want to, God will save us. But they didn't stop there. They didn't stop there. The very next verse, 18. But even if he doesn't, we want to make it clear to you, your majesty, we will never serve your gods or worship the gold statue you have set up. Listen, because this is an important, important thing when it comes to understanding your relationship with Jesus. Just because he is able to rescue you from all those things that we just talked about in the moment doesn't mean he always will. And there will be people who will tell you, if you have problems in your life, it's simply because you just don't have enough faith. Because if you believe Jesus enough, he will remove every trouble from your life. I know people who believe that that's what the scripture teaches. I don't see that here in the story of these three guys. What I see is them having absolute, he will. But if he doesn't, that doesn't change my trust in him. It doesn't change my trust in him. There are some things, some circumstances that are beyond your control. There are some things that you will never be able to change, no matter how much faith you have. But the question doesn't go away. And the question is, in whom are you trusting? These guys made up their mind. I'm not going to trust this king, and I'm not going to trust his God. I'm going to trust the one true God. I'm in touch with reality here. King Nebuchadnezzar is in touch with his fantasy. He's slaying windmills. And I'm not going down that road. The kind of God that I have is a God who can rescue and will rescue me, but if he chooses not to, for whatever his reasons are, if he chooses not to, it won't change my trust and my confidence in him. Now, this is what faith is. Because if your faith requires that God does everything you want him to do and rescues you from every fiery furnace, if that's the faith that you have, then I'm telling you, you have more faith in the things you can see than you have faith in God. Because then your trust is in danger of being put in the things you see. Every time you ask God for something, he gives it to you, wham, you got it, now you believe. And so you see it, then you believe it. That's not faith. Faith is, I believe it, even if I never see it. So look at the book of Hebrews real quick. Hebrews chapter 11. We're going to start at verse 32. I'll breeze through this fairly quickly. But I want you to see two different kinds of responses of God to people's faith. The faith is identical in these two categories of people. So the writer of Hebrews says, how much more do I need to say? It would take too long to recount the stories of the faith of this category of people, Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, and all the prophets. By faith, these people did miraculous things. They had their prayers answered, in other words. By faith, these people did these things. They overthrew kingdoms. They ruled with justice. They received what God promised them. They shut the mouths of lions. They quenched the flames of fire, which we'll see next week. They escaped death by the edge of the sword. Their weakness was turned to strength. They became strong in battle and put whole armies to flight. Women received their loved ones back again from the death. Now, that's one category of people. Now, notice this shift. But others, there's a different category. But others were tortured, refusing to turn from God in order to be set free. Turn from God and be set free. Bow down to my statue and you guys will be free to go. No, they didn't do it. Others were tortured, refusing to turn from God in order to be set free. They placed their hope in a better life after the resurrection. Some were jeered at, and their backs were cut open with whips. Others were chained in prisons. Some died by stoning. Some were sawed in half. Others were killed with the sword. Some went about wearing skins of sheep and goats, destitute and oppressed and mistreated. They were too good for this world. No, you see that phrase? That category of people were too good for this world, wandering over deserts and mountains, hiding in caves and holes in the ground. All these people earned a good reputation. Why? Because they were good people? No. Why do they earn a good reputation? Because of their faith. Yet none of them received all that God had promised. You see that category? The first category, they received what God promised them. The second category, none of them received all that God had promised. Why? Because, verse 40, God had something better in mind for us. Now you and I get brought into their story. God had something better for us. And what is that? They would not reach perfection without us. What's he talking about? He's talking about at the end of days, when yourself is totally sinless, and your sinless self is now living in a perfected body that doesn't get old, that doesn't get sick, that never dies. That day, those people and you and I will be in that place, reach perfection at the same time. That's what God has in mind. Our sinless selves inside of a deathless, resurrected body, that's coming for all of us. That's what God has for us. The faith that these people had is the same faith as the people who saw or received everything God had promised them. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego show us what real faith is. I believe in God. What kind of a God do you have? I have the God that can set me free from whatever trial I'm facing right now. And if he doesn't choose for whatever reasons he has, if he doesn't set me free, I already know he can. But if he doesn't, I'm not bound down to anything else. I will still choose him. You see, if you always get, okay, I won't say you. If I always get everything I ask for, I know what I would do. I'd put myself on the throne and say, don't I have a wonderful life and what a great person I am, and I'm the center of the universe because everything goes the way I want it to. And God has his reasons. Someday he'll help, maybe he'll show me. God has his reasons for answering my prayers no, many, many times. The question is, am I going to choose him or am I going to look for somebody else to worship? We're all in that same boat, every one of us. Who are you going to serve? What kind of a God do you have? What kind of a God do you have? Let's pray together. God, I'm grateful that the God we have is a God who saves and a God who rescues. Not only do you save us from hell tomorrow, but you are a God who saves us and rescues us from hell today. We have a God who is powerful. We have a God who is greater than the biggest megalomaniac in the world, and sometimes it's ourselves. We have a God who's greater. And this morning, Lord, I pray that in you, we would bank our life. These are unstable times we're living in. There is a lot of insecurity these days, and many of us are looking for strength, a strong foundation, some security in our life. I pray, Jesus, that we would all come to see that you are the God over all things. There is no God beside you. And that you are a God who will rescue us. And even if you don't, we will still put our trust in you. We trust you with our life. God, thank you that you are a God who is able. That's the kind of God we have, and we love you. Amen.